This program is a production of the LA Sound Posse and is dedicated to the public domain. Please feel free to copy and share it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized civic media. The following is a symposium entitled The Costs of Moral Courage, Truth-Telling and Its Consequences. It was recorded at the 30th Annual Conference of the Association for Moral Education in Dana Point, California, on November 10, 2004.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Paul Stangemann, and along with my colleague Dan Kelly, whom you've just met, we are the moderators for this panel, The Costs of Moral Courage, Truth-Telling and Its Consequences. Serving on this panel with such an ominous title, I'm honored, but at the same time, frankly, humbled to be in the presence of these three distinguished panelists. Their moral courage led each of them not to retreat from personal or professional consequence, but to do the right thing, to make the right choice. We educators argue that life in a democratic society demands that citizens confront moral issues and make intelligent decisions that are personally and publicly defensible. But very few of us are called to act at great risk in order to serve a greater good. And yet, isn't that at the center of what it means to be fully present and to be part of the human community? The title of our panel, The Costs of Moral Courage, Truth-Telling and Its Consequences, puts a single oath taken long ago by each of us as United States military veterans, once again to the test. The words, "I do solemnly swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic," continue to have import and meaning for each of us, especially in this time of preemptive war, erosion of civil liberties, the undermining of educational promise, environmental plunder, and the list, well, it goes on and on. The words of this oath live every day for Dennis Stout, who has spent the last 35 years seeking justice for crimes committed by fellow soldiers during the Vietnam War. They live every day for the Reverend Dorothy Mackey, whose mission evolved from her own abuse suffered at the hands of those to whom we entrust the defense of our country. They live every day for Anne Wright, a former diplomat who resigned in protest over the Bush administration's foreign and domestic policies. Each of these truth tellers embody the moral courage we need today to uphold the very ethical and democratic principles this educational association champions. But as important as educators and citizens, we need to understand the costs of their moral courage, how their unfettered will toward worthy ends, as one psychologist describes moral courage, necessarily kept them from flinching from the challenge, the pain, the difficulty, and the danger of acting, despite, no doubt, their own all-too-human fears. And we must add perseverance to that equation. In their perseverance, they refuse to compromise their freedom by embracing a false authority. And yet, it would only be natural to want to back off, to take the path of least resistance when moral dilemmas confront us, to set oneself free from that risk and potential consequence by submitting to the will and intimidation of others. The renowned Indian spiritual teacher and author Jiddu Krishnamurti clarifies just how misguided that would be when he writes that we seem to think that freedom is an ultimate end, a goal, and that in order to become free, we must first submit ourselves to various forms of suppression and intimidation. We hope to achieve freedom through conformity, but are not the means as important as the end? Does not the means shape the end? Does not the means shape the end? Lately, I've been offering my students an old W.H. Auden poem, The Unknown Citizen. That makes Krishnamurti's assertion much more salient. It underscores what can result when the democratic society can no longer clarify and transmit its values to future generations, and we wind up with a very different way of life. The poem begins as a dedication to a monument with the parenthetical, to JS/07M378. This marble monument is erected by the state. And the poem starts, he was found by the Bureau of Statistics to be one against whom there was no official complaint, and all the reports on his conduct agree that, in the modern sense of an old-fashioned word, he was a saint, for in everything he did, he served the greater community. The poem goes on to detail the nameless citizen's adherence to a life overly determined by the state, by sanction and policy. Its final lines are unsettling, and they echo Krishnamurti's caveat about means shaping the end. Our researchers in public opinion are content that he held the proper opinions for that time of year. When there was peace, he was for peace. When there was war, he went. He was married and added 5 children to the population, which our eugenist says was the right number for a parent of his generation. And our teachers report that he never interfered with their education. Was he free? Was he happy? The question is absurd. Had anything been wrong, we should certainly have heard. During this first part of the session, the truths these panelists will offer will have a chance to be heard. And I'm sure for some of us, these truths may even interfere with our education. After this presentation, we'll have an opportunity to dialogue with them about those experiences and to help us make connections to moral education. I'm pleased to introduce our first panelist, Dennis Stout.
Well, my name is Dennis Stout, as he said. And during 1966 and 67, I served with the 1st 327th Infantry of the 101st Airborne Infantry. I was a paratrooper and an infantryman in Vietnam. I could talk a long time about our subject. Each of us could do a lot today. So I'm going to skim over some of the things, but I'll be around for any questions afterwards, and I'll stay as long as anybody has any questions. But our unit in the war was considered a promotional unit because we were an airborne infantry unit, and there were only two brigades in the country at the time, the 173rd Airborne and the 101st. And so any West Point officer, or any officer for that matter, who was airborne qualified and a infantryman, had to serve with a combat unit to get his promotion. So we had new officers. We had a new general every 30 days, new bird colonels every 30 days, and new lieutenant colonels and majors and captains every 45 days, and new lieutenants every 4 months, though very few lieutenants lived the 4 months, or most were wounded or killed within the 4 months. To get these combat required for their promotions, if we went more than 5 days without what they called significant enemy contact, we would be moved from one area of Vietnam to another where there were more enemy. And so all through my first 7 months, there were there were war crimes being committed, but on a very random basis, you know, maybe once every 2 weeks or once every week and a half, something like that. But then we were moved north to an area called the Songwei Valley near the town of Duc Pho was our base. And it was called a free fire zone where everyone in there was supposed to be an enemy. They had come through and taken the people out, the ones they could find, but most of them were taken to government centers where they were just had to sleep on bare ground with no roof overhead and had to work in government rice fields that were controlled by the commanders of the things, and they had to pay a bribe to even live under a roof. And they would be mortared occasionally while they were in these camps, so they would escape and go back home. So a lot of people were missed in the initial sweep, and then people had come back home. And we were told that these people were a resource that the enemy could use to dig holes and carry rice, and we had to deprive the enemy of his resource. And it was the first time we'd been in a free fire zone, and coincidentally, Right at that time, the U.S. Army started using body count as one of the things you could get for promotion. If you got the right body count, you could get a promotion. So our officers, some of them, including the generals, only had 30 days to get enough body count to get their promotion. So the frequency of the war crimes increased, and finally, after the rape of a young girl about 16 or 17, she was raped for 2 nights and then blown up with a hand grenade and then shot. I couldn't take anymore, so I walked cross country by myself to our base and reported the war crimes. I went up the chain of command. I first went to my sergeant major and reported to him that I had witnessed war crimes. He said, "Keep quiet about this or you'll get a lot of good people in trouble." So I went to my captain and told him, and he told me, "You better shut up about this." So then I went to the chaplain because I thought the chaplain would care about this. And also once a month, the chaplains got to go to Vietnam or to Saigon for a chaplain's conference. And I wanted him to go there and get investigators to come back and investigate what was happening in the unit. And he turned me into the sergeant major as a troublemaker. So I was called into a meeting 2 hours later where with the sergeant major, a captain, and another captain that I was told was from general staff. And the exact words were, "Stout, if you didn't have such a good combat record, you'd be dead already. But as it is, if you say one more word about this, you won't come back alive from the next operation." So I was dismissed. I left the tent. And I kept quiet about it for the rest of my tour. I was sent to Fort Huachuca after that for 2 surgeries at the hospital there. And then I got out and trained troops until my discharge in 1969. And immediately after my discharge, the My Lai massacre story broke in the press. And I came forward with the 8 war crimes that I could most closely document. You know, I saw many war crimes and violations of the Geneva Convention, but I came forward with the 8 war crimes where I had ID cards. These ID cards were laminated cards given by the South Vietnamese government to people that were supposed to be loyal citizens, and we didn't acknowledge them at all. We shot everybody. So I took some of those cards, though, that I had saved. I had the location on the ground within 30 meters or 50 meters for some of the crimes and the names and unit numbers of the people that committed the crimes. And I came forward with the 8 that I most closely could document. One was the rape and murder of that girl. The attempted skinning of an old man that was tied to a tree and then this guy wanted to skin him, and chopping a prisoner apart, tying a prisoner we'd captured to a tree and chopping him apart from the bottom up, and shooting of an old woman that I captured, and the killing of 35 to 50 people who tried to save themselves by bunching up in a rice paddy because they thought we wouldn't kill them all if they all came into one spot. But as the unit began shooting people, the colonel landed his helicopter and came just storming over to the lieutenant. And I thought, wow, somebody's going to interfere, you know, stop this. And instead, he locked the lieutenant in a position of extreme attention called the brace, where you're really braced back. And he said, "Lieutenant, don't you kill these people out here in the open. You take them over in the bushes and kill them." And stormed back to his helicopter and took off again. So the people dragged them all in the bushes and killed them. The people we were killing in the valley were mothers, little kids, and old people. If you look at the unit's kill records, 1 month we had 618 enemy killed and only 11 weapons captured. And I was present when they found 7 of those buried in a hole. So they were obviously killing civilians. If you look at the radio logs, one platoon reports killing 29 enemy 1 month and capturing 1 weapon. So it wasn't fighting the enemy. There was heavy fighting going on surrounding the valley in the mountains. There was extremely heavy fighting. But in the valley itself, it was light sniper fire, landmines. We were mainly exterminating the people to deprive the enemy of a resource. Well, when I came forward in 1969, I was interrogated by the CID. The CID is the Criminal Investigation Division. They're like the detectives of the Army. They investigate a crime, or, you know, possible crimes, and then they make recommendations up to a prosecutor, and then he decides whether to charge people or not. And at that, I turned in my evidence, you know, did all the reporting, And then after that, I became a part of the peace movement, Arizona State University, and I was the first combat veteran to be a part of the peace movement at that time. And because I had done this, I got telephone calls threatening to kill my girls if I let them go out and play in the yard. The woman called my wife while I was at school and said I was having an affair with her and I really loved her and why didn't my wife let me go? My boss, who was a Barry Goldwater Republican, got a visit. He said, I went into work one day and he said, I got a visit from two guys in suits. And they told me you're an agent of a foreign power. But he said, I don't do what the government tells me to, so you still got your job. And my VA benefits for my education were held up for 10 months. And then at the end of that 10 months, they sent me a check. And I had to deposit immediately and write some checks on it. And when I did, they all bounced. So I went to the bank to find out what happened. And a young banker took me over to his desk and he said, all I can tell you is when someone comes with a federal badge, I do what they tell me to. So then I was going to make a speech at the federal building in downtown Phoenix, a peace march and a speech. And two men showed up at the door the night before with CID identification, but they weren't people I had met before. They came in the living room with my wife and I, and they said, if you make that speech tomorrow, you could leave for work one of these days and disappear, and no one would ever know what happened to you. And then they poked me really hard in the chest and said, and you know we can do it too, don't you? So I knew they could. So I made the speech the next day and then hid out at a friend's house overnight. And I had already arranged to go to Hawaii and help a friend of mine frame a house for 2 weeks so I could think of what to do. Then I sent for my wife and kids to come stay in Hawaii. And for 7 years after this, every year, an agent would show up and fill out what they called a field report on me. And I didn't commit any crimes. I was trying to get the government to obey the law. I didn't commit any crimes at all. But that went on for 7 years until I made friends with the last two guys that investigated me. And the last one asked me what I wanted to write. And he'd never filled out one of those reports before, what I wanted him to write. And I said, well, just tell him I want to raise my kids and do my business and be left alone. And I don't know what he wrote, but they hadn't bothered me after that. Now, all through this time, I tried to find out what was going on with the investigation. I kept making inquiries. They said they couldn't investigate. It was behind enemy lines. They couldn't do anything. No one was coming forward. No one would back up my story. They inferred that I was crazy, you know, just all these sort of things. And so after we established relations with Vietnam again, I started inquiring again. And my senators over the years, Udall and, now McCain, and then Dennis Kucinich has helped me on this, and the two state representatives, they've all gotten letters back saying there was no such investigation. Last year, the Toledo Blade newspaper, you know, from Ohio, started printing articles, and a friend of a girlfriend of mine, a sister of a girlfriend of mine, called and said, you know those stories that Dennis tells? They're in our paper here. So I emailed the Toledo Blade and said, hi, I'm Dennis Stout. I think I know something about that. And they said, oh, that's where you are. They couldn't find me. They had a colonel who was dying of cancer had given them a box of documents, and they'd started researching, and they kept running into the Stout investigation. It turns out the Army had done a thorough investigation immediately in 1969, had interviewed over 100 people, and a week after I came forward, Nixon mentions it on one of his tapes, war crimes investigation. So they had interviewed people, they had documented everything that I said, and found more war crimes. I only reported 8. They wound up recommending prosecution of 14 Americans for 18 war crimes. And after the Toledo Blade did a 15-part series that won the Pulitzer Prize last year for investigative journalism, and it was thoroughly fact-checked because of all the past problems they've had with the Pulitzer Prize. After that was done, the Army reinvestigated the case again and came to see me and had a, they don't call them interrogations anymore, we had a 5-hour interview. But I had gotten a partial record of the initial investigation from the National Archives because it had been declassified. And so when the investigators came to question me, I said, have you ever found any of the original investigation? They said, no, we can't find any of it at all. I said, well, here's a copy. So I gave them a copy of the investigation, and in there are cross-reference numbers. For every fact that's corroborated by another testimony, there's a number that refers to that investigation. So they wound up uncovering 3 feet worth of documents about this, and it's reclassified now. So we still don't have access to it. But the reinvestigation recommended the prosecution of 18 people for 23 war crimes. and they list the killing of at least 3,000 unarmed civilians, consisting mostly of mothers, little kids, and old people, in a five-month period just by our unit. So the original investigation was killed by Donald Rumsfeld when he was Secretary of Defense under Gerald Ford. He was Deputy Defense Secretary before that, and this was on his desk, and he was aware of it. And as soon as he became Defense Secretary, he killed it. Now it's gone all the way back up to his desk again, and of course, I don't expect much action on it back from him this time. But I'm continuing on with it. I'm gathering more information from other soldiers, getting affidavits, pictures, anything they have about war crimes committed, and a copy is going to the Vietnamese government to put in their Museum of Atrocities. A copy is going back with a citizen of Vietnam so she can translate it for the people in the valley so that they're not forgotten. And now that I have the radio logs telling where each person was killed, they can cross-reference that and file for reparations now that the Army has admitted that this did happen. Yeah, it's okay, thanks. Yeah. So it's, I want to say that it is very difficult to come forward. If you, there was on the 20-year anniversary of the My Lai massacre, one of the, I don't know, it was a Dateline, I think, did an interview of some of the original people in the platoon. And when they interviewed the platoon leader, or the platoon sergeant, said, what if one of your men had refused to shoot these people? He said, I would have shot him on the spot for being a coward. So coming forward can take great risks. You know, it can be really punishing, and it can mean years of disruption. But if I had not come forward, I wouldn't be alive today. I had to do this. I had to come forward and turn this in, and no matter what I've gone through, the guilt would have eaten me up if I hadn't done it. You know, when I worked for the Smedley Butler Brigade of Veterans for Peace, and we had a veterans outreach program in Boston, and the guys living under the bridges drinking out of paper bags are mostly guilty either for what they did or what they didn't do. And guilt is just an all-consuming thing. The more it is fed, the more it wants. You know, it's something that people who have this in their past can't ever take joy in what they do, because if they get high praise for doing something, they always know they have this fault within them. It's something that people become monsters, and they cannot unmonster themselves. You know, our unit's selected pretty much for sociopaths. And we wound up with a lot of sociopaths, and it was a wonderful home for them. They could kill and torture and rape and get promotions for it. We had one man who claimed to have killed 1,000 people, and he really didn't kill 1,000 people, but he probably killed 400 or 500, including grabbing a baby away from a mother and chopping its head off to take its necklace. And he got awards for those things. He got medals and praise. And there's a picture of one of the worst guys lined up getting medals, and he had already killed 260 people. Now, he wasn't killing 260 enemy. That's just ridiculous. And the idea that the officers didn't know, this idea of rogue soldiers now in Abu Ghraib and these other things, is absolutely false. Anyone who's ever been in the military knows that these soldiers cannot do this without the approval of a lieutenant. You know, a lieutenant has a very close relationship with his platoon. They couldn't get away with something for 5 months without the lieutenant knowing. The captain would have to know what's going on in his company. And if these officers don't know what's going on in their units, they're still guilty. Under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, they have to know what goes on in those units. Anything that's committed in that unit, they are responsible for. To see now that they're charging low-level people again with war crimes instead of going to the top. This comes from the top. It does not come up from the bottom. And before I finish, I'll just give you an example. The Marine Corps had bases near where we were doing all these crimes. The Marine Corps had, at least the ones at that time in that base that I've talked to, had a different policy. See, civilians are always killed accidentally in war. That happens all the time. But if there was an intentional killing of a civilian, the Marine Corps would call that guy in and chew him out and take away his pay, possibly reduce him in rank, and let everyone know that was not approved. When I first reported these in 1969, the Songbae Valley is also where My Lai was committed later. If they had come down really hard on just six soldiers, we call it coming down with both boots on them, there wouldn't have been a My Lai, and there wouldn't have been a Lai K, which was a village just a mile away where the same number of people were killed on that day, but because we don't have any photographs, no one knows about it. Those things would not have occurred if the Army had enforced its own rules. And no one that I know that reports war crimes is saying that all soldiers did this. We're saying some soldiers do this. On the back of my pickup truck, I have a sticker that says, 101st Airborne, proudly served, because I did proudly serve in the 101st Airborne. The idea that some people committed crimes, then they should be prosecuted. Those people who do things wrong should be prosecuted no matter what country they're fighting for. And it's like, if we don't have a set of rules like this, our soldiers are endangered everywhere. We can't expect people to treat our soldiers well when we torture and kill theirs. When Abu Ghraib happened, by the Army's own admission, they had already killed 49 prisoners in custody. And we're not charging people with those killings. We're charging, one guy was convicted and got 8 months. Martha Stewart got 5 months for lying to stock investigators. And the recent guy got 8 years in prison. Would we be happy if the man was caught that was chopping off Americans' heads and as punishment he got eight years in prison and a bad discharge from his army? There has to be an equivalency. We have to face up to our responsibilities. So I'm taking a copy of these records to the through Europe and to the International Court of The Hague, and I'm turning it into the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. I know that they don't have jurisdiction in these cases, and we've exempted ourselves from any prosecutions, but I want someone to archive these. There is no statute of limitations on war crimes, and I want someone to save these records for future use, because not only did when I reported these war crimes did they investigate and discover they were true, they let them continue for almost 2 more years. And that guilt goes through General Westmoreland, it goes up to the White House, it goes through everyone in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Everyone was made aware of it back then, and they let it continue. Those killings, they are responsible for. And I'm sorry, I'm rolling on here, but I have to continue this, at least to turn these records in. And I want to tell you that someone in the audience tonight that lived through these things in Vietnam, she's in the audience tonight, and she's written 2 books about this. One was called When Heaven and Earth Change Places. This was made into a movie called Between Heaven and Earth. And her new book, Child of War, Woman of Peace. Her name is Laylee Hayslip, and she's here. Would you stand up, Laylee? She lived through these things that we went to. Thank you, and I'll be available afterwards if you have any questions.
There's a little whoops. We'd like to introduce Dorothy Mackey. Dorothy has made an extraordinary stand against violence, and I think that her words will speak for themselves.
I was a commander in the United States Air Force, and I worked with some extraordinary men and women. My first assignment was working with fighter pilots, and then I was selected as a commander to work with the maintenance people, the people that fixed the jets and made sure the bombs and various things were taken care of for the jets. In the first 5 years of my military service career, I was raped 3 times. Twice by U.S. military doctors during mandatory appointments. Now, as a commander, I was responsible, again, for holding people accountable and ensuring that they were prosecuted for any type of criminal behavior. But what I witnessed after each one of these traumas was that there was no place to go in the military chain of command. Because, you see, every one of us have an instinct, and that instinct is to know whether or not you have the availability to find people who truly care and are compassionate. While I was serving overseas in Germany, I had the opportunity as a commander to get into what we call quality of force meetings. We would talk about the criminal issues going on our base. And on just one base, there were 5 child molesters. 5. There was more than enough evidence to put each one of those people in prison for many, many years. And yet, there was only one that was sent to prison, and he was a minority black man. He was in my unit. And the rest of them, they simply let them go home to where they were molesting their daughters. On the same base, I had a good non-commissioned officer, he was the middle manager of the enlisted group, come to me and said, "Captain, we have a problem." He says, "Our guys are intentionally selecting the newly assigned American women coming to Germany to get them drunk to either rape or gang rape them." Now, at that time, in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which was the military's book, legal book, of how you do your daily business, and if you committed a crime, those were crimes. So I went immediately to the legal office, to the prosecutor, and I told her what was going on. And I had this young man in tow. And she said, "We're not going to touch it." And I said, "Excuse me? We're not going to touch it because they were drinking." Now see, remember, I was a criminal justice major. So I knew that that was a crime, but she wasn't going to touch it. So I wrote an article for all the base commander, the hierarchy, the equivalent in school districts to the superintendent. And I sent it all the way up to the chain of our command and told them what was going on. Do you know that article was never published? It was never published to let the American women know what was happening to them by their own military troops. I was reassigned. I received a special duty assignment where I went and I did contract negotiations. Now see, this isn't just about abuse, my own abuse, but it's what I witnessed, because most people are turned off about rape. They simply don't understand how absolutely atrocious this is and how it will come back to get all of us. But I was buying jet parts and pieces. And you see, it was my requirement that I was supposed to negotiate the fair and best price. But what I was told is, "You're supposed to give away the money. Give away the money and justify it." And I wouldn't do it. And time again, I was told to give away the money. And there was something instinctually in me that told me that if I dared to do it, it was going to be a catch-22. That later on, sometime down the line, they would come back and get me and possibly prosecute me for fraud, waste, and abuse of giving away the American taxpayers' money. I could not do that job anymore, so I finally got myself into another command position. I thought I was back into the place I needed to be. And I was a commander at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for a 3-star general, a 1-star general, a full colonel, and a lieutenant colonel. Their annual budget, $20 billion in 1 year. It's where they make all the great airplanes, where they design the weapon systems, the gas masks. And within 2 weeks of that job, I noticed that there was obstruction of justice, that they were actually allowing for the abuse of women with domestic violence cases. There was child endangerment, in which no one was doing anything about it. There was taking of taxpayers' money by the inspector general, who was my boss. Now, the inspector general is the complaint system in the United States military. And it was my belief I was supposed to stand up and do what's right at that point as well. The long and the short is, for the next year, I was tag-team assaulted by two men. Groped, grabbed, humiliated, and literally sent to my end as far as my military career. I had enlisted women come to me and say, "Captain, if you do not leave this job, those two men will kill you." And I knew it. In 2 weeks, and this had gone on for months, in 2 weeks, because the abuse got so overwhelming, I lost 20 pounds. I started disassociating from my body as the men were groping and grabbing me, as I was being screamed at and yelled at. And I was told military members do not have a right. They have no rights. I resigned my commission because I knew that the abuse was not going to stop. And I decided at that point that I needed to do something about it. Now, up to this point, I had forgotten. I had literally blocked out the 3 rapes that I'd been through in my early Air Force career. Because the mind will not let you remember things if you are not in a safe environment to share them. That's one of the gifts of the human mind. I ended up going to everybody and their brother in our government, to include the president, asking for assistance to hold these people accountable, because I believe that the United States military, my Constitution, could not be violated because of what they did to me. I went to the Justice Department 3 times, where they told me that they could not help me. And after going through 200 attorneys, one attorney stepped forward and said, "Sure, we'll help you." We took a civil lawsuit because I did not believe the American public needed to pay for their wrongdoings. And 5 days before we were to go to trial, the Justice Department, our prosecutors of this country, came in to represent my assailants against me in a court of law. They represent my attackers against me. This case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, in which I learned that there were four other women's cases, military women, who had been raped, abused, retaliated against, stalked, one was murdered. Military members can rape, maim, or murder their own or others and get absolute immunity through the United States Supreme Court. In the U.S. Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, the Justice Department stated, and I quote, "They could not bring my case to trial for national security reasons. To do so would be a disruption of good order, morale, and discipline." We filed in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court refused to hear my case, and by doing so, they gave immunity to my attackers. The first case, Stubbs versus U.S. She was an Army woman who was sexually assaulted by an NCO, her drill instructor. The retaliation was so brutal that she went home on vacation and she dreaded going back. And in front of her sister, she took a shotgun and blew off her head. Her family brought a lawsuit against her attacker. And through this system and five immunity laws, the Justice Department gave her attacker and the leadership immunity. The Collins case is an Air Force case, identical, same situation. She killed herself as well. Her family, again, brought the case against her attacker, and they gave immunity. The O'Neill case was the next one in line. She was a Naval Academy cadet. She was being stalked by another Naval Academy cadet. She continued to go up through the chain of command. No one did anything about it. They commissioned both of them into the United States Navy. Her stalker was actually a Navy nuclear submarine officer. He not only had to have a high security clearance, but a lot of psychological tests to make sure he was stable. Yet he was stalking her. She was so frightened by this person and kept asking for help that she invited a young man over to help to protect her. On that night, she and her male friend were murdered. Now, while the stalker and murderer was held accountable, the Navy leadership was not, and they all got immunity. My case, they gave them immunity, as well as the United States government. And then the final case here is Sarah Smith. She was actually from the Aberdeen Proving Ground, the rape scandal in Maryland, in which there were multiple men who were raping the women, purposely taking them off base, and the leadership knew about this. The long and the short of that was, is that only one man was sent to prison for 25 years, and he happened to be an African American. Because you see, in the military, they selectively prosecute, not holding everybody accountable. This does go all the way to the top. And here are your immunity laws. These still have standing today on the books, and these have been absolutely stretched well beyond the context. That is the Farish Doctrine, the Bivens Doctrine, Title VII, Intramilitary Immunity, and U.S. Code 552A. The first two are virtually simply rules of conduct. And what happens if military members must take actions? For instance, a surgeon must cut off someone's leg in battle to save their life. But what has happened over the years is it's been stretched out to actually cover criminal conduct. The Bivens Doctrine is virtually the same. It envelopes or dovetails right into the back of the Farish Doctrine. Title VII, U.S. military members do not have civil rights. This is a denial of the civil rights. Intramilitary immunity. That it, while I was in the Air Force, if I was attacked by any other service member other than Air Force, that they would have immunity, even though we're all under the same Uniform Code of Military Justice. It doesn't apply equally. And U.S. Code 552A. Now, for educators, this is something that all of you should very much be aware of. Because what this does is that for military members who come out of the military in which they have been involved in sexual inappropriate abuse, domestic violence, or any type of egregious behavior, This rule makes invisible their internal records from background investigation checks, either at an FBI level or local state level. It makes them invisible, their background checks. What are the facts of this? How many cases are there really? Here's just a few statistics. There have been 200,000 American military women who have been assaulted. We're not talking simply about grope and grabbing. We're talking about egregious attacks against them, not just catcalls. 30% of the women have been raped, 30%. The average civilian rape in America, statistically, is 11%. And yet in the military, it has been 30%, and these are low statistics. STAMP, my organization that I founded, we have 4,600 cases. The shirts up here are just a few of the shirts from my survivors. Of the 4,600 cases, there has been only three prosecutions, and there was amazing, overwhelming evidence in each one of the cases. From the East Asian Pacific nations of Korea, Okinawa, mainland Japan, the Philippines, and Thailand, there's been well over 60,000 cases of U.S. military members' abuses against civilians, which include rape and brutalization of men, women, and children, and murder. It was often standard operating procedure when military members abused people simply to put them on an airplane and send them to the next assignment without prosecution. With the Air Force Academy scandal that happened, I had 16 of those cadets come forward. And it wasn't just this group of military members that were involved. It had been previous leaderships that were involved, and yet to this day, no one has been held accountable. I want to show you, in the military, there's something known as a dining out. It's the equivalent of a high school prom, but at a college level with military. This was actually on a table flyer at the Air Force Academy dining out. You shut the fuck up. We'll protect America. Keep out of our fucking way, liberal pussies. This was the table flyer. Now, they also did a sketch, and it was approved by the head of the Fine Arts Department, a lieutenant colonel. In that skit, they had two cadets that were performing the skit in which it said, how to stimulate a woman's clitoris, how to stimulate her nipples to get the vaginal juices flowing to put in a penis. They performed this in front of an entire group, and then they took it around the country on the taxpayer's dollar for a year. This did not come out in the press, but when it did finally come out in the press through a congressional complaint, they spun it in the press so that it wouldn't look all that bad, but they removed the lieutenant colonel and put him at the prep school teaching the young high school students that were preparing to go to the Air Force Academy. This was before this last year's Air Force Academy scandal, in which there were over 320 sexual assaults, 13 of which included male cadets that never made the press. There's something called the McDowell Checklist, and I discovered it. The McDowell Checklist is the United States military put together 57 questions to throw out legitimate rape victims' testimonies. As Dennis stated, each military service has a criminal investigative service, pretty much the equivalent of the FBI for the US government. The 57 questions were weighted questions, and this is the score sheet. The score sheet is between, each question would get a half a point to 5 points each. Here are some of the questions from that score sheet. Now, if you will notice, 0 to 15 points, it's unequivocal, ambiguous, uncertain outcome of doubtful nature. If you got 16 to 35 questions, it was allegation probably false, 36 to 75 false allegations, and 76 points and up was overkill. Now, when victims came in and they would talk about their rapes to the criminal, supposedly unbiased investigators, with every detail they got, they would get points. McDowell, his first premise on this rape permission checklist was that 60% of all victims coming forward were lying. 60% were lying, even though the FBI's national statistics on false report was only 10%. So it was significantly higher, supposedly, in the military. He also said of the victims that they were narcissistic, sociopaths, and immature. And this was the guy who put together the 57 questions. The questions, for instance, were, if there was a gun used, the victim would get points. They were over the threshold of zero. They were lying. If there was a knife used, they would get points, 3 points. They were over the threshold of zero. They're lying. If they were abducted, if there by any chance he wore a mask or had gloves, each one of these, the victim got points. They were over the threshold of zero. They were lying. The problem with this is that there was no way any rape victim could pass, could actually be legitimized as having been raped. This was not just taught inside the U.S. military, but to civilian police, judges, and law enforcement, as well as prosecuting defense attorneys throughout America. This is still being unofficially used and was used between 1980s and the 1990s. Now, the Pentagon has stated that between the 1950s and 2000, that rape has come down, been in fact cut in half. Here I have from the Justice Department, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, special reports. I just wanted to show you the first page. In this report, it states that the number one reason for military members to be in military prisons was sexual assault. 1 out of 3 military members are in prison for sexual assault. Of veterans, after they leave the service in federal, state, and local government, in prisons, the number one reason for them to be in prisons is sexual assault. They are in 15% higher than the civilian population for sexual assault in our military prisons. Here are just a few of the names of people who have come out of the United States military. See if you know some of the names. Jeffrey Dahmer, who actually learned how to do autopsies in the United States Army. Berkowitz, DeSalvo, Yates, Francois from New York, Ridgway from California, the killer of Polly Class, Richard Allen Davis, Wesley Allen Dodd from Connecticut and Maine area. These are all serial killers that came out of the United States military, or children of military. Ted Bundy, who was known to kill possibly 200 women across this country, to include a 14-year-old child in Florida. Eric Harris, the Columbine shooter, as well as John Wayne Gacy, the killer, serial killer of young boys, young boys as well as young men, who then buried children under his property in Chicago. With Abu Ghraib, the Taguba report stated that a female detainee was having sex. Not that she was raped, but that she was having sex. Currently, what is happening is they've narrowly redefined the Geneva Convention, in which you either must damage a major body organ or you can't kill the person. But if you kill the person during interrogation or interviewing, as Dennis said, then that does not count as a war crime. To date, the United States government will not sign making rape a war crime. We will not sign the ICC, International Criminal Court, unless military get immunity. And there are many international laws that allow for military to do abuses against other people. Part of this is about the cost of what has happened. I lost my military career. I lost my marriage. I will honestly say that I was institutionalized because I was suicidal. I met an extraordinary human being in 1994 who encouraged me to go do what I needed to do, to speak up, to get healed, to take my humanity back. And Shortly before 1999, I was invited to go speak at The Hague for Peace with the East Asian Pacific delegation to speak up about what they had been through and what we understood together as a group. And the week before I left, my partner Bruce was murdered, and I was told that if I go and speak at The Hague, that my life was at risk and they could take me out at any time. Being naive at that time and very connected at on my spiritual path, which was about nonviolence, I said to the person who threatened my life, my paperwork is everywhere. Anybody who knows me knows that if anything happens to me, my government would do it. And I said, you take your best shot because I'll die with a microphone in my hand. And I just went off and did what I needed to do. But the repercussions are extraordinary because I've had to pay for my own healing and well-being. When we ask, let's support our troops, I will tell you the mass majority of the men and women who have decided to serve, served under the false pretext of, we do this job to deter war. We do this job to ensure peace. And yet I have found through the weapon systems that I was associated to that many of the jets were put up knowing they were not going to fly well, that they had faulty weapon systems in them, that the combat pilots would not get out alive, not because of their great talents, but because the canopies would not blow off when the jet was having problems. And yet I read message traffic coming down from the senior leadership of the Air Force that said, if any military dares to share this information outside of the military, we will fully prosecute you to the ends of the law. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Anne Wright. Anne was the former ambassador to Mongolia, and she's here with us today from Hawaii.
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you, these stories are very compelling stories that we've just heard. Experiences of people that have been through some very, very terrible and difficult times. I myself worked for you, the people of the United States, those of you all who are from the United States, and for 35 years, 29 years in and out of the U.S. military, 13 years on active duty and 16 years in the reserve component. And then when I was in the reserve component, I switched over to the Foreign Service and became a U.S. diplomat. I served under 7 administrations and was involved in some issues that the U.S. government had that I think looking back on it now, I kind of wish I hadn't been involved in them. But my career ranged from, Grenada back, 20 years ago. I was with the U.S. military then going into Grenada. Nicaragua, the last days of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Somalia. Working there with the United Nations, being the chief of the Justice Division, of trying to reconstitute the Somali police, judicial system, and prison system, helping open a new embassy for the United States in the former Soviet Union, the republic, now independent country of Uzbekistan, and then going to Kyrgyzstan for 2 years, and then to West Africa, to Sierra Leone, and was there during the terrible days of all of the chopping of arms and legs where the Revolutionary United Front overran that country. Then going to Micronesia in the Pacific. Then going to Afghanistan and reopening the U.S. Embassy there in December of 2001, following the U.S. The tragedy that befell the United States on September 11th of 2001 and then the subsequent military action in Afghanistan to push al-Qaeda out and the Taliban out, which I thought was an appropriate gesture on the part of the United States after September 11th. Then I went on to my next assignment, which was Mongolia. And I do thank you for the promotion. I was the deputy ambassador in Mongolia, not the ambassador. But it was in Mongolia. Well, it was actually in Afghanistan when I and everyone else that was a part of the U.S. embassy there was noticing the diversion of resources from Afghanistan resources, human resources, and economic resources that we really needed in order to accomplish a mission in Afghanistan of economic development and security stabilization. We noticed it definitely after President Bush, in his State of the Union message in January of 2002, decided that there were other areas of concern for the United States, other countries that the United States needed to watch out for: Iran, North Korea, and Iraq. And with that statement of the axis of evil, the diversion of resources became quite noticeable. I went on to my next assignment in Mongolia, and it was there where the process of the United States moving toward war in Iraq continued. And you all know the story of that. I myself, being far away from the policy-making venue of Washington, really knew not much more than what you all knew by watching CNN or BBC or any of the various networks. Probably if you watched the BBC, you knew more than those that were watching CNN. But I was very concerned about the direction of our government, of the U.S. government. And for all the reasons that you all, that we know now, the United States going into an oil-rich Arab country, the probability of the creation of endless more people that were angry at the United States, the probability of lashing out at the United States for doing something as stupid as going into an oil-rich Arab country. Well, anyway, I, along with two other people in the U.S. Diplomatic Corps, decided that I could no longer support the policies of the Bush administration, particularly on going into war in Iraq. But I thought, well, if I'm going to resign from the U.S. government, from my 35-year career, then I ought to go ahead and just tell the U.S. government what else I disagreed with. So in one of the longest resignation letters, I think, in the history of the State Department, one page for at least every decade that I'd served, I identified that I thought that the Bush administration's lack of policy on North Korea, lack of doing anything to resolve that issue, and this was 18 months ago, almost 20 months ago now. Subsequently, of course, there's been the multilateral discussions with North Korea. But also I mentioned that the lack of effort on trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian issues, and then the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties in the United States under the Patriot Act. And, you know, other than that, I thought the administration was doing fine. But anyway, I was one of three people, only three people, that have resigned from the U.S. government in opposition to primarily the war in Iraq. It's not like, there have been other people that have resigned from the federal government over other reasons earlier in my career, for issues that I didn't resign over. So I don't take, the question always comes up, why haven't more people resigned if indeed there is such a disenchantment with the war in Iraq? Well, getting feedback from my colleagues in the State Department, and in fact in the first 3 days after I'd resigned, being in Mongolia, I couldn't actually just leave Mongolia the day I resigned, which is generally the way you have to do after you leave federal service, but it's hard to get out of Mongolia. And so I was there and received over 400 emails from colleagues of mine in the State Department who expressed such great concern about what was happening. And the reasons that they decided they couldn't resign ranged from everything, well, you just think about your normal life, you know, kids in college, kids in high school, this, that, and the other thing. And then probably the best part, the most reasonable explanation, is that a lot of people decide that they can stay in the system and try to work within the system and try to affect change there. But on something as fundamentally as serious as going to war, I felt that, for me, I could not go along with this one, so I resigned. The costs, what we're talking about today, the costs of moral courage, truth-telling, and its consequences. Well, I think for you as educators, and here, you know, I, It's odd, some of the places that I've been speaking since I've resigned from the government. I would say that the consequences of truth-telling are great. I mean, I've gotten to meet so many new people, wonderful people, and be associated with new organizations that I would never in my wildest dream have thought that I'd be speaking with. That's one of the consequences, that indeed you're free. You have the freedom, once you resign, to speak your mind. And to me, that has been the most uplifting and important thing I think I've done. Certainly, working for the government for 35 years, I felt it was important, and I felt in many ways that we were doing a pretty good job in the various areas of concern that I worked with. But that I think gives you the basis on which to evaluate the importance of then the freedom to speak your mind and the background that you bring to conversations about things like foreign policy, things like military operations, things like international law and how the United States is perceived in the world. There are a lot of people who are speaking out, and it's kind of hard though to find where they are. But if you keep watching the newspapers and start clipping little articles, all of a sudden you'll start seeing that there are a lot of people that are speaking out. If you think back, you'll hear from Daniel Ellsberg, one of the top speaker outers, one of the top truth tellers from the Vietnam days with the 7,000 pages of Pentagon Papers. You'll hear from him on Saturday night. But of the more recent people who have been speaking their mind to the government, if you think of the FBI, Colleen Rowley, the FBI lawyer who was telling the FBI, you've got to start checking all of the flight schools in the United States because there's something strange going on here. There are a lot of Saudi Arabian young men that seem to be taking lessons and are learning just certain parts of flying. She's still with the FBI, even though she has spoken out. And I think if she says the reason she's still with them, they haven't fired her, is because she's a lawyer and she'll definitely sue them. But another person from the FBI, Sybil Edmonds, the young woman who was a translator for the FBI and who called the FBI's hand on the fact that her translations were being changed by her supervisor, and in fact that her supervisor was telling all of the translators to slow down their translations, even though they were trying to get through all this multitude of materials that had developed prior to 9/11 and after 9/11. But the FBI senior translator was telling the junior translator, slow down, because if we go through this pile of translations too fast, I mean, we won't be able to hire more people. So slow down so we can hire more people. So she called the FBI's hand on that. She got fired, but she's speaking out. If you look in Great Britain, the young lady, Kathleen Gunn, who in defiance of the Secrets Act of Great Britain came forward to say that she, as a signals analyst, had been told to overhear, to listen in on the conversations of the nations that were on the Security Council of the United Nations before the vote on whether to authorize military action there. She was prosecuted by the UK, and then halfway through the prosecution, the UK pulled the case, so she never was actually convicted of anything. If you look at just recently, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers contracting officer, who is now coming out publicly to say that the sole source contracts that went to Halliburton and organizations like that, that those were illegal, and she was telling the senior leadership of the Department of Defense that they were illegal, but nobody listened to her. They just went ahead. If you think of the British ambassador to the country, Central Asian country of Uzbekistan, who's now been relieved of his mission in Uzbekistan because he publicly said that the United States and the UK were using information that was gained from people that were being tortured, and in fact some that were being boiled by the very brutal government of Uzbekistan that for years has been known for violations of human rights, but is now the good buddy of the United States and the UK in this war on terrorism. A good buddy because we work from an air base in Uzbekistan to support operations in Afghanistan. Here's a UK ambassador that's been relieved of his job for telling the truth. Well, there are consequences. And for me, resignation was actually the best and easiest. I could resign and then start telling what I felt. Telling the truth, telling the honest truth. For me, the consequences are freedom. I haven't been subjected to the types of interference and government watchfulness over one's activities as Dennis and Dorothy have. Although I must say that in the last 4 months, as I've been speaking out more and more and more and more with the lead up to the election, that at least 90% of the time that I fly on an airplane, I am selected for special security investigations there. You know, going through the special line, the long line where everything that you own is looked at. And always the TSA guys are very, very nice. Oh, ma'am, we're so sorry. You've been selected by the computer for special screening, and it'll just take us a few minutes. And I say, oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry. I've got a nice book here, and just take your time. I was prepared for it because I get pulled aside every time. And they said, every time? What do you mean? I said, well, every time, because it seems like people don't like for me to speak out against the war in Iraq. That's the only reason I can think that I'm selected virtually every time. And most of the TSA people will say, well, that's not fair. I'm against the war in Iraq, too. And you shouldn't be pulled over. Well, as they start going through all of my suitcases and everything, then they start seeing the flyers that say, well, Ann Wright has been speaking here or there, or they saw the various political stickers. And I'll tell you, TSA was a very fertile recruiting grounds for people who were not particularly for many of the policies of the current government. We got rid of a lot of stickers that way. Well, for me, as I said, I have not suffered the consequences that these two fine people have. But what I would say to you as educators, that the messages I think that we want to present to you is that our young men and women that are in our schools, whether they be in elementary schools and high schools or in colleges, they really need to have the opportunity to hear of the types of stories that we tell, of the challenges that we as citizens have, the challenges, the obligations, and the responsibilities that we have. And these obligations sometimes come. You pay a high price when you assume the obligations and the responsibilities of telling the truth, and telling the truth to the people that we always hope are good, benevolent people that run our government, the people that we elect. And as you can see, over this has been a 30-year process here that we now see that there are elements within virtually every administration who don't do right by the people who elect them. And so we as citizens have to be vigilant, and we have to be discriminating, and we have to really watch what our government's doing. So our messages, I think, that we would like for you to take back to the communities that you come from are that we can't give up hope. We have to keep fighting. But we have to be really watchful of all of our liberties. We can't let them be taken from us. They are so important, and they are the foundation of our United States. And those have been the foundation of many of the countries of the world, too. So I think the whole world is rooting for America, that we kind of take back the goodness that we've had of our country, and be watchful so that no one takes it away from us ever again. Thank you so much.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.